Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Hello, everyone.
Hannah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
We're at it again.
Here we go.
Welcome back to another round of Hannah Hansplains Things to people who know more than me most of the time. I am Hannah McCarthy.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
I'm Nick Capodice.
I'm Christina Phillips.
And this is Civics 101, the podcast where, on occasion, we sit around a table and gab about the state of the country on mic instead of via furious texting on the group chat. And today, I want to talk about a Supreme Court case from 221 years ago and a Supreme Court case from 2 days in the future.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. So the case from 221 years ago, some would say it's old news, but it's news that still makes a difference to this day. 1803, Marbury versus Madison. I am not going to lay out the whole thing right here. Don't worry about that. But does anyone here have a summary? Rebecca Lavoie.
Yeah. Both of their hands went up like the most excited
so
children.
Excited.
But Nick, Rebecca's never on.
Yeah,
the
let her go ahead. I've done enough on this.
This is one that I actually know, okay? And only in part because I watched John Adams on HBO, okay? So I know that when Jefferson beat John Adams for the presidency, before John Adams left office, he and Congress passed a law that allowed him to basically create all these new judgeships. And Marbury was appointed to be, I think, a Justice of the Peace in Washington, D.C. And then when Jefferson became president, those papers were never delivered so that Marbury could get his judgeship. And he was mad about it. He didn't like it at all. So he went to the Supreme Court and said, I need those papers to be delivered. And they, in a unanimous decision, not only said they ruled for Marbury, but they also said the entire law was unconstitutional, thereby setting the precedent that the Supreme Court could declare a law unconstitutional.
And in fact, the court said, while Madison is breaking the law, we can't even talk about it.
That's right.
Because so Marbury's right, but we cannot force anyone to issue a writ of mandamus because this law is unconstitutional.
That's right. And Marbury never got to be a judge.
His whole life, he just wanted to be a judge.
That's all he wanted.
I'm glad to know how you say mandamus now, because I was like, mandamus?
Yeah.
A writ.
I think it's like
mandamus.
It's like certiorari.
Yes.
Certiorari.
A
writ of mandamus. Yeah. Sounds like Matt Damon.
How do you like them apples?
Let me ask you this. When the court said this law that Congress passed right before Jefferson came in is unconstitutional, what was the court doing?
Is this the magical expression judicial review?
That's right.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's that the judicial branch doesn't do stuff. That's the executive branch's job. Judicial review means that it is their job to interpret the Constitution and to decide what laws are constitutional or not. They can't make you do something, but they can tell you that a law should or should not exist.
It was the first time that judicial review was applied, right? Like, so before the Constitution was kind of seen as symbolic, and this was the first time that it was like, oh no, the law of the Constitution is above the law written by Congress.
Yeah, it was the Supreme Court giving itself the power to which we now associate it today.
There it is.
Oh,
okay. So that's the big thing with Marbury versus Madison. The Supreme Court, as had been hinted of before but never actually stated explicitly, was like, actually, yeah, we do have the crown of judicial review. We get to interpret the Constitution. So what does this have to do with this future case that I'm talking about? Kind of nothing in terms of judicial review, but a lot in terms of Marbury versus Madison. So I was reading through Marbury versus Madison a few weeks ago, as you do, and
in the tub with a glass of wine,
enjoying myself, relaxing, unwinding after a long day. And I came across some passages that I had never paid attention to before, because Marbury versus Madison, judicial review, fascinating. That's the point of it, right? And I'm reading these paragraphs in the opinion, and I'm thinking to myself, I kind of laughed. I was like, you know, if I were the lawyer of a former president facing criminal charges, I would probably try something like this, like what I was reading in the opinion of Marbury versus Madison from 1803. So, Rebecca, can I ask you to read one paragraph in particular? This is the one that, like, got me thinking.
So here's the quote from John Marshall. "The province of the court is solely to decide on the rights of individuals, not to inquire how the executive or executive officers perform duties in which they have a discretion. Questions in their nature political or which are, by the Constitution and laws, submitted to the executive can never be made in this court."
Hmm.
Ooh. Anyone have any little shinings of thought before we dig in here?
I just want to say I never knew this was part of Marbury versus Madison. I just
big
always
old part.
I always tied it to the judicial review, not to this question of politics.
Yeah. But they're basically saying they can't decide political matters.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. But the big important part of that, Rebecca, is not to inquire how the executive or executive officers perform duties in which they have a discretion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's right? A big deal.
That's a big deal.
And we've heard echoes of that in some of the court cases that we've heard in recent news, where it's like when somebody is president, they have alleged presidential immunity, maybe. And that's kind of maybe what this is hinting at a little bit.
Yeah.
You are not saying that in the upcoming case about former President Donald Trump, people are looking at Marbury versus Madison as precedent.
I am. Wow. It is cited quite a bit. So the Supreme Court case 2 days in the future. Can anyone tell me what this case is that I'm referring to?
This is the question of presidential immunity, whether or not Trump is immune from criminal charges for actions he took leading up to January 6th and the riot on the Capitol, and whether he can be prosecuted by the Justice Department.
Yep. So I read the brief that former President Donald Trump's lawyers actually did send to the Supreme Court in anticipation of this trial. And lo and behold, former President Trump's lawyers are quoting Marbury versus Madison like it is going out of style.
Wow.
So my question is, what is this? Like, what's going on? What does it mean to say that the Supreme Court is not to inquire how the executive performs duties in which they have a discretion? So I talked to someone smarter than me. Shall we hear from him?
Yes,
sure.
Please.
So the political question doctrine is essentially made by the Supreme Court. It's law made by the Supreme Court that says there are some cases, some legal issues that are better left to the other branches of the federal government, such as the executive branch and the legislative branch. And there are various reasons for why that is. So, for example, the political question doctrine has been invoked when it comes to, say, certain military actions when the president has the very clear mandate as commander in chief. The court decides, hey, it's probably best that we don't interfere when, for example, the executive branch has a clearly granted constitutional authority.
So that is Professor Wayne Unger, assistant professor at Quinnipiac University School of Law. And a major shout out to Wayne for saving my hide, because I was hunched over attempting to make sure I knew what I was talking about today. And he was like, yeah, I got you. So any initial thoughts about what you just heard from Wayne? He's talking about something called the political question doctrine. And that is what we call this idea about the Supreme Court not having anything to do with ruling on, issuing opinions on the official duties of a president.
I guess my initial thought is, how do you define official duties of the president, right? So is there a job description for the president of the United States? And when do you decide that the president is coloring outside of those lines?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
But as Nick and I have talked about in the past, the only job description for the president is in the Constitution, first and foremost, to uphold that, the Constitution. And then, you know, there are a lot of laws that Congress has passed that have to do with the functioning of the United States that the president has to abide by. But we know the president is commander in chief, for example, and the head of the executive branch, which is huge.
What's interesting to me is that when it comes to Congress, like, there is so much more in the Constitution about what falls under the purview of the legislative branch, and there's quite a bit less about what the president is responsible for doing, and there's, like, nothing about what the Supreme Court is responsible for doing.
Right.
So I just feel like when it gets to what can the president do, there's going to be a lot of interpretation as opposed to just taking the words in the Constitution itself.
So this political question doctrine thing, we have the court saying, you know, yes, Marbury is do this, but no, we can't order anyone to do it. Why can't we order anyone to do it? Well, because this law is unconstitutional, but also because this is a political question. And the court at this particular time is looking at Adams and Jefferson and Madison and Marbury, and they're like, no way. Like, we are not messing around with all of this.
Right. Because it was just an election, and this act was passed in part to frustrate Jefferson, right?
Oh,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was a political act. You know, some say that Jefferson threw the things in a fire.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not. But so the Supreme Court is basically like, I don't want to touch this, you know, like, because the ramifications could fall on us. Like, we made a big mistake and everybody's going to get really mad.
So this dynamic is, if the Chief Justice had said, you must deliver the commission that authorizes Marbury to take his position, there was a good chance that Marbury would not have received it because Thomas Jefferson and James Madison would have refused to deliver it. So that is the dynamic that kind of set up the kind of origin, so to speak, of the political question doctrine, where there are some actions that Article III, the federal courts, should not wade into and stop short of doing because of a political reason of sorts.
Right. It's a political question. It's kind of murky, but the court doesn't want to wade into it. But obviously, it's the Supreme Court. They can't just say, well, this is political. We can't do anything about that. So, you know, even though these are just like six dudes meeting in whatever space in the new Capitol building they were allowed to meet in, because it's 1803, the court is new, they don't have their own space, they are still the highest court in the land. They have to have a reason for why they're doing things. So the political question doctrine is born. Now, does everyone feel like they get what the political question doctrine is?
I do, but I wouldn't mind hearing you say it one more time.
All right. I'm going to have Wayne weigh in here before we keep going. How about that?
The political question doctrine is, in a way, very intangible. I, of course, don't use that in the literal sense of intangibility versus tangibility, but I say it as a kind of loose standard, right? Where the federal courts loosely apply it. Sometimes they rigidly stick to it. Sometimes they deviate from it when something could be a political question. I'll give you an example because I teach constitutional law to first year law students. Political question, that doctrine is oftentimes difficult for first year law students to understand because, well, you could make an argument that a case before the court is a political question, and then you can make another argument that it is not a political question, and then the court ultimately has to decide whether it is or is not. All of that is to say, there is great debate as far as what is a political question or not.
Did this come up in Bush v. Gore?
We're going to get to Bush v. Gore. So this is, Bush v. Gore comes up.
It's slightly detached.
Democrats charge a confusing ballot layout led voters to think they were punching the ballot for Al Gore when they were actually voting for Reform Party candidate Pat Buchanan.
3,500 people did not vote for Pat Buchanan. Come on, this is heavily Democrat at Palm Beach County.
It is a ballot that was approved by an elected Democratic official. And hey, guess what? There were no complaints until after the election.
What I want everyone to remember over the course of this episode is that the court just gets to decide what it's going to do. It gets to decide
yes.
what is best and why, where it gets to weigh in and where it doesn't. And there is this principle established in Marbury versus Madison. Does it mean that they have to rigidly adhere to various interpretations of it? No.
I do not think that there is a Supreme Court case that we have talked about on this show out of like 20 that could not be argued was political in nature. Like every single one.
And to be absolutely clear, the political question doctrine, as laid out in Marbury versus Madison, is specific to the executive and official acts of the executive and executive officers.
Okay.
It is not separate from that. It's not all notions that could be remotely political. It has to do specifically with the executive branch.
Got it.
And kind of messing with the executive branch. So I do want to say the court did actually refine what makes a political question a political question. It's in a case called Baker v. Carr, 1962. I am not going to go over the specifics now because I think I would bore you guys, but I'm going to put it in the web post for this episode in case people want to know what these political questions are. But Wayne said he uses an example with his first year law students, right, to try to explain the political question doctrine. And this is an example of the court weighing in on something the president did in the course of his duties, his official duties, right, which include following the law. That is a duty, right? Does anyone here remember Biden v. Nebraska 2023?
I mean, yeah. We probably all do in this room.
Sure.
Wasn't this the forgiveness of student loans
yes.
case that went before the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court said you can't do that?
Tonight, the Supreme Court dealing a major defeat to President Biden, striking down his plan to erase more than $400 billion in federal student loan debt. Chief Justice.
So the HEROES Act had a provision that allowed the Secretary of Education to waive or modify certain financial assistance programs. Biden is promising anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000 of student loan debt forgiveness for all people who are having their loans facilitated by the federal government, right? And so this is what happened in that case.
As the Biden administration argued before the Supreme Court, there was a statute that gave him the authority to, the words are, modify or waive that federal student loan program. And so that's what the Biden administration invoked. They said, hey, this is the act, the HEROES Act specifically, this statute, and these are the words that give us the authority to cancel these student loans. And those words were waive or modify. And of course, the discussion before the Supreme Court for that case was, well, what is a waiver and what is a modification? And whether a cancellation of $10,000 or $20,000 per borrower is a modification or something totally different. And ultimately, the court said, no, it's not a modification. It's not a waiver. So it's not within the zone of authority that Congress gave the President of the United States.
So some other examples of the court weighing in on the acts of a president, because the court does. And the specifics of the criminal charges and immunity question in this Trump case in 2024, that's new. But a lot of the basics of this Trump case are not at all new.
So this is not the first case where immunity, broadly defined, is before the United States Supreme Court. There have been several cases before the Supreme Court that Supreme Court has decided that established some level of immunity in different circumstances. For example, in Clinton v. Jones, the court decided that there is no constitutional immunity for a president of the United States for unofficial acts applied in the civil context. So civil and unofficial, no immunity. And then you have criminal and kind of a criminal investigation, whether a president is immune from a criminal investigation. In short, we've had a couple of criminal subpoenas issued to presidents of the United States, and the court has said, no, you are not above the law. You have to respond to the subpoena. One of them being Nixon v. Fitzgerald. Another one being the Watergate tapes, where in that case, Nixon said, I'm not going to disclose the tapes. And that worked its way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says a broad claim of immunity does not supersede the very specific ask to produce these tapes to further, you know, in the administration of criminal justice.
So I want to mention, you heard Nixon v. Fitzgerald. That's different from the Watergate case, right? And importantly different, too. And Trump's lawyers make sure to cite Nixon v. Fitzgerald specifically.
Yes.
But not the Watergate case specifically.
Makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And the Nixon v. Fitzgerald case very specifically uses the term absolute immunity.
Remind me what Nixon v. Fitzgerald was specifically.
So what happened is that Nixon fired someone after they testified about like a really messy way in which the Air Force was building an airplane. This person testified before Congress and said that it's inefficient and it's a misuse of funds, essentially. So this person sued for wrongful termination damages, and the Supreme Court said, we're sorry, but Nixon is immune because this was an official act, even if it was an official act on the outer perimeter of Nixon's duties as president. So Trump's lawyers are arguing, first and foremost, in their brief, the Supreme Court told us way back in Marbury versus Madison that they cannot, as in the court cannot, weigh in on the official acts of a president. Okay, Christina, can you read the first mention of Marbury versus Madison in this brief for us?
So in Marbury versus Madison, this court held that a president's official acts, quote, can never be examinable by the courts, end quote, a doctrine that this court has reaffirmed over two centuries.
All right, so this brief submitted by Trump's lawyers says this five times, quote, can never be examinable by the courts. I want to say, I think this is important, that this is taken a little out of context. Now, I read Marbury versus Madison. I've read it several times. This quote, two things. One, is used in reference to an officer of the executive branch, not the president. You could argue that that doesn't have a meaningful difference because the whole point is that the officer is executing the will of the president, okay? So, yeah. So even though Marbury versus Madison doesn't explicitly say presidential acts can never be examinable by the court, that's the implication, right? But number two, this passage, it being quoted by Trump's lawyers, is immediately followed by a quote, but.
Oh, there it is.
And I'm going to get to that. First of all, though, Rebecca, here we go. Official acts, right? This is a term that does not exist anywhere in Marbury versus Madison. At no point did they use the phrase official acts. What do we think it means? What do we think the official act of a president is?
I'll be honest. It seems like it could be loose, like a thing that you expect a president to do. Sign laws, meet with people, engage in conversations about the budget, give speeches, you know, talk about policy. I mean, a broad variety of things, right? But like, there are supposed to be things that you are not supposed to do as an official act of president. Like your campaign for your next presidency is not supposed to be an official act, right? Like your raising money is not supposed to be an official act. There are things that we know are not supposed to be, but I'm not sure that's a definition of things that are official acts, right?
The word official acts means related to the office, right? So these are acts that are in the office of the president. So my question is like eating a meal part of the office of a president? Is like sleeping, like all these things that you do while you're president, can they be called official because you're doing them while you are in the office?
I think that's a great question. I don't know the answer to the eating thing.
Yeah, I shouldn't have brought that up. But again, it feels like official acts. What is official and what is unofficial? That's laid out in the Constitution, and the Constitution's pretty barren on what the official acts of the president are.
Well, I think that the thing that you brought up with Marbury versus Madison, that the fact that it feels a little out of context, because Marbury versus Madison is specifically talking about an official carrying out an act that the president gave them to do. Like, the president said, you should do this. And if we're thinking about this Trump immunity case in the January 6th, like, a lot of the things that are cited in that case are former President Trump telling people to do things or getting on calls with his official staff and people that he works with, that he employs. And so that feels like an official act if it's something that, like, he is telling somebody else to do or he's doing with people that are under him.
In Marbury versus Madison itself, the opinion references, quote, duties in which they have a discretion, they being the president, quote, the will of the president. And actually, Nick, if I could have you read just one last paragraph, I think this one lays it out in a pretty straightforward way. I see it as like, this is a baby Supreme Court trying to figure everything out. This is kind of how they're trying to define what a presidential act is.
By the Constitution of the United States, the president is invested with certain important political powers, in the exercise of which he is to use his own discretion and is accountable only to his country in his political character and to his own conscience.
Oh.
Wow.
It's not getting tighter. It's getting looser.
The butt's coming. The big old butt.
Okay. Yeah, where's the big old butt?
I'm going to get to the big old butt. But yeah, I thought this was really, really interesting because when I first read this in Marbury versus Madison, I felt like the will of the president, his discretion, his conscience, that's so much wiggle room.
Yeah, it's like Magna Carta. It's like the divine right of God has blessed your conscience to understand what to do.
Yeah, but I think what's also really important is that the Supreme Court starts to talk about later in Marbury versus Madison that the president is doing things for the country and not addressing individual rights. And once we start thinking about the rights of the people, things get a little more complicated. And in actual fact, John Marshall complicates it. That's part of his butt.
I love the optimism of 18th and early 19th century elected people and people on the Supreme Court. Like, you could not write something like this or think something like this if you ever suspected that someone would be elected to the presidency that would take this idea and use it just to their complete advantage, right? They're assuming that everybody who's going to be elected to this office ever is going to be a good person and completely live by these ideals. And that's really optimistic. And I kind of love that.
I think that's there. I mean, when I was reading Nixon v. Fitzgerald, the court is like, you know, it seems like in granting absolute immunity for civil cases that there's no recourse when it comes to the president doing something that someone feels like is an injury. But of course, there's lots of recourse. There's impeachment. And then one of the things they note, they essentially say, like, the president has a duty to the people and wouldn't want to embarrass himself.
Would never, ever, ever. Yeah, no. No president would ever, like, step over any lines of any kind.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
There's a whole lot of, like, you know, assuming that feelings matter in this situation. And I mean,
dignity. Yeah. And, you know, decorum and like, all the things that's like, it's like everybody's going to be George Washington. Everybody's going to be Thomas Jefferson. It's always going to be like sending message by horseback. So the message has to be really important. Like the assumptions of the times are just really astonishing to read now.
Yeah. When they later refine Marbury versus Madison political question doctrine in Baker v. Carr in 1962, the sixth thing under the political question doctrine, like what makes it something that the court can't mess with, is if multiple branches disagreeing on something would cause great embarrassment.
Wow.
We can't do anything about it. Like, and it's like, what does that mean? How do you define great embarrassment?
It means that like England looks at us and goes,
we told you so.
Okay, so I keep promising that I'm going to get to that thing, that big butt in Marbury versus Madison, and I promise I am almost there. But before we get there, we need to take a quick break. And one thing I ask of you, fair listener, if you have ever heard the show and have learned a little something, like maybe the things hidden in famous Supreme Court decisions that you never knew were there, consider making a donation to Civics 101 to support our work. This show costs a lot to make, and it's made at a public radio station where resources are scarce and good journalism matters above all else. You can pitch in to keep Civics 101 coming your way at civics101podcast.org or by clicking the link in your show notes. We'll be right back.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too.
Aw,
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Welcome back to Civics 101. I'm Hannah McCarthy. And today on this special roundtable, Handsplains edition of the show, we are digging into what Marbury versus Madison has to do with a Supreme Court case happening in 2 days involving former President Donald Trump and whether he has immunity around acts leading up to the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Before the break, we were talking about what makes an official act. I should just say, I mean, I could tell you all of the details of it, but Trump's lawyers go through every single one of his criminal allegations, and they basically say all of this is under the umbrella of official acts, like you were saying, Christina. So, like, he tweeted about election fraud. That was a paramount federal concern, had to be addressed by government officials, asked the attorney general and the Department of Justice to investigate. He suspected election crimes. That was within his rights and duties, right? He told state officials to exercise their official responsibilities given the suspected fraud. What could be wrong with that? He told the vice president, the vice president's office, and Congress to act according to their official duties in the face of widespread fraud. And at one point, the brief mentions the fact that Trump had lots of data, lots of information pertaining to this widespread fraud. So it was grounded, it was based in something, the suspicion. Then Trump spurred people to come up with alternate electors to help the vice president in his official duties. So all official duties, official duties, official duties.
Not about re-election, about executing the job.
Right. Especially in the face of crime.
Got it.
So the brief also says that the court has reaffirmed the political question doctrine as late as Nixon v. Fitzgerald. And the logic is that the president needs to focus on his job without being bothered by legal threats. Quote, because of the singular importance of the president's duties, diversion of his energies by concern with private lawsuits would raise unique risks to the effective functioning of government, unquote. But importantly, this is about, again, a quote here, merely private suits for damages based on a president's official acts. Private suits, civil cases.
I'm just going to say a lot of the language in this, it sounds a lot like the qualified immunity language around police officers, right? Mm. That they can't be worried about what will happen while they're performing the duties of their job as a police officer. It's the same language.
Yeah. Wayne actually talked about qualified immunity. I just didn't have space for it because this is a long one, but exactly, right? Qualified immunity, that's the whole idea. And so Trump's lawyers, when they're talking about this criminal stuff, they're like, well, criminal suits are even more dire and really, really, really should not be allowed to mess with a president's official acts. We especially shouldn't allow a president to be taken up on criminal charges. And this brief says, Justice Brett Kavanaugh agrees with us.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh, when he was on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, so then Judge Kavanaugh, he wrote a law review article for the Minnesota Law Review that argued for a deferral. What he meant by that is civil cases and criminal cases against the president of the United States, a sitting president of the United States, should be deferred until after that president leaves office because of the demands of the job. It would interfere with the person who has been elected the president and fulfilling the duties under Article 2 of the United States Constitution. And there's some, again, there's some reasonableness and validity to that. But the Trump brief kind of goes down this route where it implies that Justice Kavanaugh, then Judge Kavanaugh, supported absolute immunity. That's not true, because he says in his article, Brett Kavanaugh, that criminal prosecution should be deferred until after a president leaves office, which is based on the fundamental premise that a president can be held criminally liable. Because if we think about it, why would he make an argument that you should defer criminal prosecution if he believed that the president is immune from criminal liability, right? You wouldn't make that argument.
I should clarify that Professor Wayne Unger did write an article. I can't remember the exact title of it, but it was essentially, if my law student submitted this brief, I would give them an F.
Oh, wow.
If you look at the actual legal, historical, constitutional, and first-person account evidence. The question before the court is not actually, does the political question doctrine apply here? The question is, right? Like all Supreme Court cases have like usually one big question, maybe a couple of bullet points after that. But the question with this case is, quote, does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? And if so, to what extent? But of course, to answer that, especially given the brief that Trump's lawyers submitted, the political question doctrine, they say it's a major factor. So it's likely that the court can't ignore that. We'll have to wrestle with that, right? Because the lawyers are saying that the Supreme Court already established that it cannot review the official actions of a president.
Well, Marbury versus Madison, as he quotes, and as we highlighted, there is language in that case that says there are certain acts by the president of the United States that are not reviewable by the court. But where he misses is the very next sentence in the Marbury versus Madison opinion. And that very next sentence says, but there are some circumstances in which we can review. So Trump's attorneys made it appear, or Trump's brief makes it appear, that it's a hard, bright line rule that Article III courts cannot review presidential actions, when in fact, that is just fundamentally wrong, because Article III courts review presidential actions all of the time.
What?
That's the big but.
What are they, though? What are the, do you know the things? Like, what are the instances in which the court can do it?
Well, the example that he gives is the Biden case, but regularly the court is like, can the president do that?
Yeah.
Let me look at the law that they were abiding by. Yeah. Right. And the big but in Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah. That's what we're waiting for.
Remember I told you that there was a little bit of cherry picking in terms of can never be examinable by the courts?
Yeah. Yes.
So Marshall is talking about a case in which an officer does something in his role in the executive branch and someone takes issue with it. Now, Marshall says that this officer who did whatever someone takes issue with, as his duties were prescribed by that act, this is the act under which he's acting, right? So in the case of this, they're talking about Congress establishes the Department of Foreign Affairs. There's a Department of Foreign Affairs officer. They do something. Someone takes issue with what they do. This officer, as his duties were prescribed by that act, is to conform precisely to the will of the president. He is an executive officer. He is the mere organ by whom that will is communicated. The acts of such an officer as an officer can never be examinable by the courts. But when the legislature proceeds to impose on that officer other duties, when he is directed peremptorily to perform certain acts, when the rights of individuals are dependent on the performance of those acts, he is so far the officer of the law, is amenable to the laws for his conduct, and cannot, at his discretion, sport away the vested rights of others.
Oh.
So, that's an important but.
That's a big but.
Yeah, because the president can do a lot of things, but there are also a lot of laws. And someone within the executive branch is acting according to the will of the president. Let's not question that. However, those laws often pertain to the proper execution of an American person's rights.
Yes.
If you do not facilitate that properly, if you in fact deprive someone of their rights in what you're doing, that is a different story altogether. So that's what's so important about the but.
So this is where the rights of the voter come into play, right? My rights to have my vote be counted properly. That's what they're talking about. If this section applies in this case, that's what's being discussed, right?
I would say if any of the justices bring up this section, that would be the implication, right? That we are talking about the rights of the voters. And I think that Trump and Trump's lawyers would say, I was protecting the right of the voters. There was fraud. I was making sure that there wasn't fraud in this sacred space of the election. Or someone could say, well, actually, you were depriving voters of their will, of their right, right? Let's think about what the court might say, right?
I got predictions.
You have predictions?
I got predictions till Sunday, Hannah.
What do you got?
I think it's kind of bonkers that we're all sitting in a room and talking about Marbury versus Madison as if this is the gold, this is the gold jewel that we must all cling to for the rest of our lives.
1803, man. 1803. That was
yeah. We're talking about Twitter and we're talking about rigged elections and we're talking about all this stuff that John Marshall could never have considered. That's just one little thing I want to throw out there. What I think the court is going to do is what a lot of administrations have done or what Congress has done in the past, which is to say, okay, maybe he's not the president now, because if he were the president, you know, he would be immune. It's when they're out that we can investigate it, like Brett Kavanaugh said. But there's an election coming up. And I feel like the court will say, not now, we can't talk about it because there's an election coming
because
up.
He could be the president
because he could be the president again soon, just like the Republican Party did for Supreme Court justices. You know, an election either just happened or is going to happen real soon or isn't going to happen
always
soon enough
happen
yeah
real
it's
soon.
Like Christmas.
Yeah.
So I think that the Supreme Court is going to sort of punt it and to say, like, we can only sort of look at this when the election is over, because right now it could kind of maybe still be part of that office.
Well, what I think is interesting about that is that the decision to take up this case in the first place is already kind of doing that. Because the Supreme Court, they could have let the D.C. Circuit Court decision stand, which is applied specifically to Trump and this case with Trump. And they could have still taken this issue up later. But then also taking up the decision now, as opposed to in December when Jack Smith originally asked them to, if they take it up in April, they make a decision maybe in May, there's still 3 months on that 7-month preparation period left for both sides to prepare their case, which means that the case would go before a jury, like the earliest, probably like September, but most likely October, November. So they've already sort of kind of done that. Like, no matter what they end up deciding, just the fact that they took it up in the first place, it's already sort of made it kind of irrelevant in terms of Trump in a lot of ways. Because they could still say, I mean, I guess if he's not reelected and they make a decision like saying that, no, you're not immune, that would allow this case to go forward and then have precedent for the rest of history. But if he gets reelected, he still has the power, even if he was not immune from prosecution, to now, as the head of the Justice Department, essentially overseeing it, be like, don't continue with this.
Rebecca, do you have any predictions?
I don't. You know why?
Why?
Because this court many times has not surprised me, and in some cases has very much surprised me. So I am not going to throw a take into the mix.
Okay. So if we look at this in terms of political question doctrine and immunity charges, right? Let's say that the court does not agree with Trump's lawyers' Marbury versus Madison claim. Let's say they decide that everything you're listing here that you say is an official duty isn't one, not even an outer perimeter duty. That would mean that they're saying that they can weigh in. That's just one step. And they might do that or they might not. They could also say, you're right, these are official duties, but we have only said that the president is immune in civil liability cases related to official duties. We haven't actually made a hard and fast decision about criminal liability. Mm. And, you know, moving on to the immunity question, we have to ultimately, no matter what, unless they remand, right, the court probably will say something about immunity, and not just that, absolute immunity.
There are reasonable arguments that the president should be entitled to some level of immunity, because there are decisions that need to be made by the president, which are very tough, and we can acknowledge and respect those. But I think fundamentally, to say that the president of the United States is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution is just wrong and flawed in so many different ways. Also, the Supreme Court's opinions related to immunity, both civil immunity, as well as whether they're immune from answering criminal subpoenas, all indicate that the president is not absolutely immune in the criminal justice system.
A little bit to your point, Nick, right? Mm. You know, what kind of ruling could the court issue? It doesn't have to be broad. You know, Rebecca, you brought up Bush v. Gore earlier.
Oh, it could be super duper whooper narrow, right? It only has to do with this one day.
Bush v. Gore, of course, was a very narrow decision where the court expressly said, this applies here and here only. And it's possible for the Supreme Court to do the same with the immunity case. It's possible for the Supreme Court to say, we're going to essentially find immunity with Donald Trump and his actions related to January 6th. But only now, because there could be a circumstance down the road where, you know, we don't want the president to have immunity.
The other thing to consider is this. This is the chance for this Supreme Court, those 9 justices, to rule big on a big thing, right? The criminal prosecution of a former president for things he did while he was still president. They can make it small if they want, or they could make it big.
But the other immunity cases that have come before the Supreme Court, presidential immunity, for example, Clinton v. Jones, Nixon v. Fitzgerald, the court has had opportunities to narrowly rule in a case, but instead they decided that they're going to set a legal standard that still applies today. It is somewhat of a broader standard or broader ruling. In this particular case, I would think, and this is, again, a suspicion, and the court could chart its own path here and disagree with me, but I would think that the court would say, no, we should probably set a standard that is applicable beyond this particular circumstance.
So I think that's one of the reasons that this is really important to focus on. So like kind of regardless of what happens with Trump, the Supreme Court is going to decide about criminal immunity or not, you know, like Wayne said, but like, you got this right in front of you. This is a career defining moment. I'm curious to see what 9 human beings decide to do.
Let's look at it this way. This court has made some very big swings in the last couple of years. So maybe we shouldn't be surprised if they make a really big swing this time, right?
Mm-hmm. That's all I've got. That's what's going on. I cannot wait to see what the justices have to say about the political question doctrine. I know it sounds silly because this is also a question about absolute immunity, right? But when you have the chance to affirm what, like, is a presidential act in a new way, you know, refine what a 221-year-old doctrine actually means. And, you know, when it was first established, it was at this time when the court was trying to tread lightly in politics and preserve the rule of law and the separation of powers. But today's court is just as wary of being accused of being political, right? So I just think that this is something fascinating to watch. This episode was produced by me, Hannah McCarthy, and Rebecca Lavoie. Nick Capodice is my co-host. Christina Phillips is our senior producer. If you like Civics 101, if you want more Civics 101, you can check it all out at our website, civics101podcast.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our newsletter. It's where we put all of the cool stuff that does not end up in the episodes, and I swear, it is not annoying, and we don't try to sell you anything. Music in this episode by PW, Io, Victor Lundberg, Twin Musicom, Arc de Soleil, Chris Zabriskie, Arthur Benson, Adeline Paik, and Heliznico. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR, New Hampshire Public Radio.
Right. Do you want your theme song to be kind of like butt rock, or do you want it to be like a girl kind of explaining stuff?
Butt rock a lot.
No. I want it to be jaunty. I think it should be like jaunty, like.
Da, 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 da,
yeah.
Da, da, da.
I think jaunty more so.
Folky.
What is butt?
But it's just like, it's like Leonard Skinner. Yeah, yeah. It's 2 T's.
Why?
It's like, I don't know.
It's like Uncle Rock. Like
Uncle
it's
Rock.
Like, okay,
oh,
sure.
Yeah.
You mean like hair metal?
Or kind of like, yeah, like Poison.
Yeah.
You know,
like I just spent all day working on my car in my garage. And
just
now
sort
I'm,
of rock yeah. shaking your head back and forth kind of thing.
I think it should be more like the women from the Magic Garden and the Chuckle Badge. Like,
oh, I love it.
Like hand,
that's
like,
much better.
Real folky.
Yeah.
Handsplain.
There it is.
Let's do it. Let's
there it is.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.